Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, Dr. Lisa Wojciechowski from Queensland Positive People talks about the Young and Positive research study.
So welcome to today's podcast on Young and Positive. I'm Patty Watley, the manager of HIV Online Learning Australia at AFAO. And today I will be speaking with Lisa Wojciechowski, the Life Plus Manager at Queensland Positive People. We'll dive into Lisa's amazing work on Young and Positive study, and these results will be available soon. This study aims to understand how young people living with HIV relate to their own health, living with HIV, and HIV supports and services. How are you today, Lisa?
I am very well, thanks, Patty. How are you?
Good, good. Now, before we get started, I'd love you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you sort of came along this journey.
Yeah, sure. So I am a social worker by profession, and I've been working in the HIV sector working alongside people living with HIV for a number of years now. I came across this work in my role working at the Alfred Hospital, actually, in a social work role. And I was working alongside more and more people under 30 who had been diagnosed with HIV. And I was really struck by their different perspectives and support needs and patterns of engagement, which were quite different from other cohorts of people living with HIV that I'd worked with before. So I sort of did a little bit of digging around on the interwebs and through the research, et cetera. And I found out there was actually quite a lot of factors at play as to why that might be the case. So, for example, even though people under 30 might be considered adult within our existing HIV service systems. So, for example, you've got pediatric services, which is 0 to 17, and then you basically got adult services, which are 18 to whenever, right? So people under 30 are considered adult within those structures. But actually, the research that's coming out now confirmed that there's a lot more to the picture. So, you know, developmentally, in terms of brain development and psychological development, we're now realizing that adulthood doesn't actually occur until, you know, well into the second and even the third decade of life. And in the last 20 years or so, we've also seen some pretty big social and cultural changes which have impacted our understandings of what youth actually is. So if you think about global factors like technologies and global communications and economic development and stuff like that, these sorts of things have caused shifts in the demographics of Australia. And what that's done is it's delayed the timing of role transitions, which we would typically attribute to adulthood. So things like finishing education and moving out of the family home and gaining financial independence, for example. And so these shifts in transitions have actually created bigger and more distinct portions of the life course than we've ever had before. So if you think about it, back in the day, you know, adolescence or youth was just this really small life period before childhood and adulthood, but now you're seeing a much bigger space of youth and young adulthood, emerging adulthood, and things like that. So stuff's changed. Our ideas of youth have definitely changed. The other really big thing that's going on there as well is that people under 30 with HIV in Australia today are actually diagnosed and have grown up in a super different context than other people living with HIV. And that might be, you know, obviously longer term survivors of HIV, as well as older people who might be diagnosed with HIV today. And that's because people under 30 have no living memory of, air quotes, the AIDS crisis years, the time when treatment wasn't available and when people died of HIV and AIDS. So not just that, but people under 30 are also in this treatment as prevention era where HIV is not considered a death sentence. It's considered a chronic condition. And yet, confusingly enough, surprise, surprise, HIV stigma still exists. So there's a lot sort of going on in that picture in terms of young people living with and being diagnosed with HIV. Yeah, so I guess to answer your question, going back right to the beginning, I was a social worker working in this space and working with people living with HIV under 30. And I wanted to know what was happening. Like, was it about the particular life stage that they were in? Was it about the context of being diagnosed in a post-crisis contemporary Australia? Or was it something to do with how our service sector was structured? Because, yeah, as I said before, where young people are considered adults within this service structure. And if it is to do with that, are there things that we could be doing better as a sector to meet the support needs of young people living with HIV? Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. And I suppose something I sort of took away from that as well is this, them growing up in a world that isn't HIV or AIDS as a death sentence. And I suppose, did that change the way being able to get participants to the study as well? So I suppose if it wasn't as potentially big a factor in their life, was it harder to get people that were interested to participate in this study?
So luckily, like, I guess two things. Like, one of the big findings was that, yes, actually HIV was a big factor. It just, it's different. It sort of looked different in people's lives than it might in other cohorts. And in terms of getting people to participate, I mean, that was a tricky part in terms of, we didn't really see much research in Australia or any research in Australia that focused on people under 30 living with HIV. So we knew that that was a bit of a gap that was happening, and we wanted to really consider how we might include the voices of young people living with HIV. And so with the help of my PhD supervisors, so Professor Louise Harms at the University of Melbourne, Professor Christy Newman at the University of New South Wales Centre for Social Research in Health, and Dr. Alison Carter at the Kirby Institute, they really helped me sort of form how we were going to shape this research. And part of that was to develop a steering committee. So, you know, really centred in GIPR and MIPR principles. We had a group of people who comprised of people with lived experience of being young and HIV positive, representatives from community orgs, grassroots communities, hospital-based clinical services. So these steering committee really helped right from the beginning. So everything from developing the research tools, like telling me how I need to be writing the questions, you know, having conversations with me to help me make sense of the findings, but also really importantly, putting the word out to community to be able to reach people who might potentially want to participate in the study. And while we didn't, so the total number of participants that we got was 60, which, yeah, small, but also it's still to date, from my understanding, the largest sample of people under 30 living with HIV in Australia. So, yeah, I mean, it's that chicken and egg thing, isn't it? It's people not participating because they're not seeing themselves reflected or in what the research is doing, or are they just not interested in participating? And I would argue that we just need to do more and better work at finding and speaking and targeting our messages to people under 30 living with HIV.
Amazing. And so when we look at these participants that were involved, were you able to get people from a range of different backgrounds, or were they all quite located within similar areas? How did the participants sort of look from that point of view?
Yeah, so we were able to recruit participants from most of the states in Australia apart from Tasmania and the Northern Territory, which was a shame. And like from, I guess, the survey data, you could see that participants reflected mostly the epidemiological picture of HIV more broadly in Australia. So they typically were Australian born, identifying as gay men and living in an urban location. But in terms of the interview data, so we interviewed 25 people who had participated in the survey, and we were able to gather more diverse voices that sat outside of that epidemiological picture. So women, heterosexual identifying people, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, people born with HIV, and people from or living in non-urban locations. And the inclusion of these voices was quite important because apart from being young and living with HIV, these intersecting identities and circumstances really influenced how participants understood their HIV diagnosis and what they described as needing from HIV services and supports as well. But I will say that it's obviously not a representative sample, and certainly we were missing the voices of some really key populations, for example, First Nations people and gender and diverse voices as well. But we were lucky to have participation from a wide range of people with a wide range of experiences.
So speaking with the feedback you actually got from them, when we're looking at those services and support, what things did they say might have been positive within their experience, and what gaps do you think were missing as well based on what you received?
Look, there was really, really, really varied experiences of engaging with support and also of their diagnosis of HIV or learning of their diagnosis of HIV in the case of people who had been born with HIV. Some spoke really positively about that process of being linked in with meaningful supports that really, you know, helped them, and others had just absolutely terrible experiences. Some chose not to engage with services and supports at all for various reasons as well. So, yeah, I think participants described really, I guess, the main finding or the main positive finding was that the places and spaces of support that were orientated and targeted towards young people were more successful in meeting their HIV-related support needs, basically. So outside of that, there was all sorts of different experiences, which was great because it helped us sort of understand what's working in the sector and what might be missing as well. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. And when we're sort of looking at barriers for these young people as well, so had there, based on your study and feedback you received from them, did you identify any barriers that might have been from services or support, or even just like with these gaps as well, were they able to find communities? Were there barriers within communities for themselves? Was there anything you were able to identify there as well?
Yeah, so there was a bunch of what we sort of called inner and outer world factors that impacted people's, like, whether, how, and why they might access supports around their HIV. So they were, you know, people, like I said, some people accessed formal HIV psychosocial and clinical services. Other people relied on informal support networks. Other people accessed supports through non-HIV specific services, so mainstream services. So it was really, really broad, but the common thread was that people were really creative in how they access support. So that was really cool. Like, in terms of a sense of community, a few things were going on there. There was definitely some what I would call intergenerational tensions between people from previous generations of people living with HIV and young people living with HIV. And while young people recognized the people who had come before them and the importance of their contribution to access to treatment and all of those sorts of things, there were some experiences in their interactions with other generations that were less than positive, or that their, you know, there was a sense that their experience of HIV might not be as valid, or, you know, that sort of sentiment of, well, you've got treatment now, what have you got to worry about, those sorts of things. And that was from other people living with HIV from different generations, as well as healthcare and service providers as well. In terms of the barriers, though, so the inner world sort of factors that impacted whether and how people access support around their HIV, there's quite a few. And when we talk about inner world factors, talking about the sort of individual sort of person-centered things that impacted people. So stigma, massive one, which is probably no surprise to anyone here. So, yeah, so, you know, like, if you think about for the very process of being able to receive support around your HIV, you have to disclose your status. And you have to become visible not just to the person that you're disclosing to, but you have to become visible to yourself as a person living with HIV. So that was a really big factor in decisions around accessing support. Another big one was perceptions of services. So many participants had negative perceptions of specialist HIV psychosocial services in particular. Like, most people were engaged in clinical support, they were adherent to treatment, and while they might have had some interruptions or whatever, most people had that stuff sorted. But in terms of psychosocial supports, there was a lot of perceptions around those services and how they may or may not be able to meet their needs, which really impacted whether or not they would engage. And that was That was despite or whether or not they'd actually had a go at engaging in those services. So some people just stayed away just purely based on what they thought the service would be like, regardless of if they'd tried it out. There was also a strong sense from many participants that they didn't feel that they belonged to existing HIV services or community spaces. And that was because they couldn't see other young people accessing those services or other young people with that they thought they had things in common with. And yeah, there were other internal or inner world factors like readiness to engage with support, so whether or not they wanted to accept the support, preferences to process their diagnosis on their own, like I'll do this on my own, I'm going to be okay, being too busy. And also we found mental health and substance use issues. So if they, particularly if they were co-occurring, had a really big impact on they were on people's ability for some people to remain engaged in care and support. So many of our interview participants talked about disengaging from treatment, and often mental health and substance use was connected to that in some way. Outer world factors. So when I talk about outer world factors, I'm, you know, talking about things like cultural aspects, systemic factors, service factors, things outside of, you know, our direct control potentially. Really simple stuff that, you know, would make sense for many other groups. So things like cost, paying for, you know, medication costs, being travel to your provider, Medicare eligibility, those sorts of things. Workforce. So, and that was workforce right through. So everything from your medical provider and the interpersonal style that they had right through to admin staff, which is also tied to the general vibe of a space, whether it felt comfortable as a young person to enter that space and be in that space. Hours of operation. So if you think about, a lot of young people are super busy. They might be working a job whilst also studying. So having hours that are flexible, that are outside of those times of work or study, is really important to be able to access care and support. And wait times as well. So not just a wait time, say, for example, in a clinic, you know, waiting for a doctor, but also waiting for an actual service. I had some participants talk about really wanting some psychological support around their diagnosis, but having a wait time of, you know, 2 weeks just felt like too much for them. So they just dropped out completely. So being responsive in that way was really important for them. Yeah. So I guess those are the bigger sort of inner and outer world factors that were important to participants in terms of what they wanted to see in services and supports.
That's really interesting. And so I suppose here we were looking at the services and support. I suppose it might take a little bit of a detour more about their personal lives. And you did mention that quite a lot of gay men were part of this survey. And I suppose I'm just thinking more about around dating and hookup culture within these young people as well. So did you get much information about their experiences, say, using dating apps, so Grindr, Tinder, even potentially Instagram and things like that, connecting with people, and different experience they've had dating and hooking up as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So really, like we were talking about before, really accessing support around their HIV in quite innovative and creative ways. So people definitely talked about using dating apps, obviously, as a way to hook up with people. And there was all sorts of conversations about the complications of disclosure and experiences of stigma within those places and spaces. But also, interestingly, and particularly for people who weren't necessarily linking in with formal psychosocial services and supports, some people use those dating apps as places of experimentation and finding and building community. So some people were able to see if people had disclosed their status on Grindr or Bareback, for example, and have conversations outside of sexual experiences with people to experiment with how they might talk about and disclose their status, but also to find and connect with other people living with HIV in a way that felt safe for them. Other participants talked about how they would use those platforms and talk about all sorts of things from like what treatments people are on, what they might recommend given their lifestyle and what was happening for them. So there was ways that people were connecting, and obviously connecting with other people living with HIV was really important. but they were doing it outside of what we would consider would be, you know, these formal psychosocial groups or things that are set up within the HIV sector.
Interesting. Thank you. And now that we're going to be able to have this study and looking at probably the biggest study in Australia for younger people living with HIV, with this information, what do you hope to achieve and where to next with this data?
So where to next would be having a conversation, I think, with ourselves as a sector about how we might engage young people in care and support differently, or how we might do better at doing that. So there were some really key findings that came through really clearly in the data. And the first one really is that young people want HIV support targeted to them as young people. So, and the research obviously supports that people under 30 are a different and distinct cohort, right? So the people that we interviewed really talked about there being a lack of youth representation, engagement, and visibility in existing support structures, and that this lack of youth-targeted support was, you know, it impacted their engagement patterns with these services. As I said before, they would avoid certain places and spaces or even accessing supports because they didn't feel like there was a place there for them. So that would be one change, is making places and spaces targeted to youth. And I think the first step in doing that is listening to the voices of young people in terms of what they want to see, including their voices in service co-design and delivery as well. One way of doing that is to include younger people in volunteering opportunities and creating a sense of belonging and space within our current HIV community, but also listening to the voices of young people outside of that epidemiological mainstream, like I was talking about before. So the other thing that young people said to us that was a really big finding was that they place equal value on physical and psychosocial support around HIV. So yes, most people were linked into clinical care. They were adherent to their medication. For many people, they were diagnosed and on treatment within 3 months of their diagnosis, like really, really great in terms of the biomedical aspects of HIV, fabulous. But a really high number also said that within the first 12 months of being diagnosed, they would have appreciated some kind of psychosocial support around their diagnosis, and also, you know, within the last 12 months of completing the study. So it's not about young people being born, or, you know, being diagnosed in a TASP era and HIV is not a big thing and they can take a pill a day. They place equal emphasis on the need for clinical as well as psychosocial support around HIV. Another really big thing that came through is that young people have specific needs in relation to peer support. So just having a shared lived experience of being HIV positive wasn't enough to be considered a peer for young people living with HIV, and it wasn't enough to mitigate the harmful effects of HIV stigma. So what participants were telling us was they wanted to have connection with other young people, definitely. So peers needed to be of a similar age. They also needed to have similar life experiences. And this is where these intersecting identities come in and are really important. So young women wanted to connect with other young women. Young heterosexual identifying people wanted to connect with other people who shared their sexuality. Young people living in non-urban communities wanted to connect with other people living in regional and remote spaces as well. So that was really important. And the third key factor about peer support for young people is that they wanted to connect with people that they considered to be living well with HIV. They wanted to see other young people with similar life experience living their fabulous lives, doing fabulous things with their lives. And that was what was really important for them in terms of peer support. The other big finding was that young people had distinct needs in relation to information about HIV. So young people didn't, like I said before, in terms of the physical and psychosocial aspects of HIV, young people would turn to information not just so that they could understand the impact, the physical impact that HIV was having on their body, but they wanted to know about things like, well, how is this going to affect my dating life? Can I get these certain jobs? You know, what does this mean for me? And so they wanted to find information about those sorts of things, and they wanted easy access to HIV information. They wanted it to be credible. They wanted it to be current and accurate and easily understandable. They wanted it to be neutral. So a lot of people, when they were first diagnosed, made the mistake of Googling HIV, which can be, it's not a great experience. So they wanted the information to be neutral. And by neutral, I mean not scary and not, I guess, you know, like outrageously inappropriate. But they also wanted it to be relevant and targeted to them as young people. They wanted the information that was going to, you know, that was going to speak to them as young people, be signaled to them as young people, and relate to their particular stage of life.
Amazing. So it looks like with this, there's a lot of work that the HIV community sector can do as well. Like, we've gone such a long way, but there's still so much more we can do and continue to do as well. I just want to check with you if there's any exciting or key takeaways you've had from this study that you haven't mentioned so far as well.
I think really the big key take homes are that, you know, remembering as a sector, and the cool thing is this, the sector are fabulous. And I think this is something that's been on the radar for a really long time. I think as people working in the sector, we've worked alongside, you know, younger people and understood that there's differences in support needs and access to services and support. So I think really the big messages that I would be putting forward are that young people are distinct. So they're distinct from the sort of broader adult population, which means that their support needs are distinct. There is no one type of young person living with HIV. They are diverse. And we need to be finding ways of including young voices in all levels of service design and delivery, from volunteering all the way through to membership on boards, so that we can really look at how we can better meet the support needs of people under 30 living with HIV.
Amazing. Thank you. And to finally tie this all off as well, promote yourself as much as possible. Where can we actually find out more information about this? Do you have websites? Do you have any socials or anything that people can follow you or just check for updates at all?
Yes. So, okay. Unfortunately, okay. So like I said, this is a PhD project and I've just finished the PhD at the end of last year. So the only major piece of, you know, information that's come out of this is my thesis. That's really long and boring. So I will be working on some articles and getting the messages out in more digestible ways. But a really great place to start is our website, which is just youngandpositive.com, all one word. And I'll be placing, you know, updates and other information as it comes along there. Or people are really welcome to just email me at youngandpositiveaustralia@gmail.com if people are interested in connecting or talking more about this stuff. I could talk about it all day. I could talk under wets of edge, as you probably figured out already. So, yeah, so definitely there will be more stuff coming out. Watch this space and definitely, yeah, check out the website.
Excellent. So all the updates when more information is, it'll be at youngandpositive.com, just to confirm.
Yep, absolutely.
No worries. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.